The Guardian.
Thanks, but no thanks. Britain says no to AV. Nick Clegg's hopes for electoral reform lie in tatters as Lib Dems are booted out of council offices across England.
We have taken a real knock last night, and we will need to learn the lessons from what we heard on the doorstep. But we need to get up, dust ourselves down, and move on.
Meanwhile, there's a huge swing to the SNP as Alex Salmond's party takes Scotland by storm.
We have a majority of the seats, but no monopoly on wisdom, and we'll welcome the support across the Parliament as we seek to pursue these powers for the benefit of our people and to ensure jobs in our economy.
This is Politics Weekly with me, Tom Clark, and we'll be looking at all the results from the elections, which were so thick and fast that some cephalogical nerds were calling it Super Thursday. We'll hear from our reporters and analysts around the UK, but here with me in the studio is our Guardian columnist and my fellow yes voter in the doomed referendum, Martin Kettle. So, Martin, noes have it.
Yeah, the noes do have it, unless, of course, you live in the People's Republic of Lambeth, like Citizen Wolfie Smith of the TV series a while back, because one or two places in London, which didn't have any other voting this week, and Glasgow Kelvin, where George Galloway was once the MP and Roy Jenkins before that, have voted yes. But I think you have to face the facts. It's about a 2-1 humiliation for the AV campaign. And the consequences of that, both in terms of electoral reform, which I'd like to see, and the future of the coalition, on which I'm more agnostic, I think are much more, both very difficult.
And we'll come back to all of that, and particularly the effect on the coalition in general and the Liberal Democrats in particular, in a few moments' time. But before we turn to the losers, let's concentrate for a moment on the man with the biggest grin on his face, Alex Salmond. The story of the day, until the AV vote came through, really was Alex Salmond up in Scotland doing sensationally well and far exceeding all expectations. Our correspondent in Edinburgh is Severin Carroll. Sev, this is a huge moment for Scottish politics.
It's cataclysmic. This is a most extraordinary outcome. The Scottish National Party now has a working majority in the Scottish Parliament, the kind of outcome that the Parliament was designed to avoid, simply because it's attracted so many hundreds of thousands of votes. Just looking at the current calculations, it's picking up in the region of 1.8 million votes have gone to the Scottish National Party in both the list and the constituencies. So it's a quite dramatic victory for the SNP. The SNP propaganda machine, the immensely sophisticated air war that they're so brilliant at, just came into full force. They were able to engineer their manifesto launch in a much more elegant and sophisticated way than Labour. And you just got the sense that the way the SNP were organising and leading their effort, it just seemed so much more focused and prudent than the way Labour were doing it.
There's no doubt in this election who the winners are, but let's just talk about the losers for a moment. If we focus on how many votes are cast, is it more Labour or the Liberal Democrat vote that's fallen away?
Well, it's Liberal Democrat. I mean, the Liberal Democrat vote is now, it's effectively disappeared. I mean, it has atrophied. In many seats which they previously held, they were being overtaken by the SNP that had previously been third or fourth behind them. The extent of the swings away from the Lib Dems has been absolutely enormous, and almost uniformly Lib Dem votes have gone to the SNP. Now, it's that which is the most shocking and stunning element of this.
The SNP has already been in power, of course, for 4 years in Holyrood, but it's never had the votes to deliver that all-important referendum on its defining question of independence. Now Alex Salmond's got the whip hand. Whether he wants to or not, Severin, he probably can't put this off forever, can he?
Well, I mean, Salmond has already moved beyond that. I mean, you know, the extent of the SNP's victory has made him much, much more bullish and much, much more confident about his capacity to deliver the independence referendum. He's now in a position to dictate the pace and to take the terms that he was never able to do with just a single seat lead over Labour in the last Scottish Parliament. So, in a sense, he's already knows that he's in control.
in the light of what you've been saying, Severin, it's no great surprise that Ian Gray signalled that he, as Labour leader, is going to step down in the autumn if he can last that long.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, Gray has to stay on because the party simply doesn't have any immediate obvious choices as a new leader for the party. I mean, this may be something of a kind of a nicety, of course, because the party is unlikely to elect a new leader before autumn conference anyway. But what Gray is signalling is that he wants to lead an orderly transition rather than resign in the same way that Gordon Brown did in a kind of sudden rush. And he's got agreement from Ed Miliband, which of course is self-evident as well, that they're going to have a fundamental root and branch review of the entire party. That, again, will be strike most people as the most obvious thing to do now.
Severin Carroll there in Edinburgh. Now, Martin, you followed the fortunes of Alex Salmond from a distance for quite some time, but he's exceeded his own normally bullish expectations today, hasn't he?
I think that's right, although I hesitate, only because when I was up in Edinburgh at the start of the campaign, I bumped into some pretty senior people in the SNP, and you know, we were sort of shooting the breeze off the record, and they both said, well, you know, it's not impossible. We've got the momentum going. We're, you know, things are moving our way. There's a Labour vote. It's very soft. Labour's going to be running a poor campaign. We could even get to an overall majority. Those words were uttered in my presence by some pretty senior people in the SNP. However, I don't think they were. I think they've been taken by surprise by the force and success of it. And I think it's quite possible that our old friend, the late Serge, may have carried him over the line rather unexpectedly, yes.
Severin was saying that the obvious and dire implications for Scottish Labour. What about for Ed Miliband? How far does it sour his day?
Well, I think it's bad for Scottish Labour and for Ed Miliband. I mean, Ed Miliband looks a bit silly now because he said this is where the fight back for Labour really starts when he went to Scotland, and of course it looks as though the fight back has now failed. So that's not very convenient from his point of view. I think more seriously, Scottish Labour has always been, you know, the backbone of the Parliamentary Labour Party. Labour's been able to rely on that at Westminster. Now, an election in Scotland for the Scottish Parliament is certainly not the same as an election in Scotland for the UK Parliament. Labour did very well in Scotland only 1 year ago, even with Gordon Brown as leader. So, you know, it's perfectly possible that, you know, what we're seeing here is Scottish, left-wing Scottish voters rallying behind Alex Salmond as the man to really take the fight to the coalition on Scotland's behalf. But come the UK general election, whenever that next is, Labour doing quite well. But nevertheless, yeah, they've really got to work to do that. And so, you know, there's going to be a big clear out, I think, in Scottish Labour. And the other thing, of course, is if Alex Salmond succeeds with his majority in getting the referendum when he wants it, I mean, one day down the line, there won't be any Scottish representation at Westminster anyway. And of course, that has very profound consequences, if it ever happened, for the Labour Party, because it would really, I think, make it much more likely that Labour could only ever come back into a government in the UK, what remained of the UK, in coalition, because there just simply aren't the Labour seats south of the border and in Wales.
Now, one thing Martin's written about recently is the fact that a decade or more after devolution kicked in, Scotland and Wales are beating to rather different drums. And let's head over to Cardiff now, where the elections have been taking place for the Welsh Assembly. Our reporter Steve Morris has been following events and joins us now. Labour had high hopes in Wales. How have they done?
Well, Labour's done pretty well. They would say they've done very well. They've got 30 seats. They were looking for 31 for an overall majority, 31 out of the 60 seats on the Assembly. They've fallen just short of that with 30. So it leaves them with a little bit of a problem now. They can either form a minority administration and try to run it that way, or they can jump into bed with another party. They worked with Plaid before, They might do that again, but they've had a bit of a battle during the election campaign, and Plaid haven't done very well during the election, so they may be reluctant to get back in with Labour. They won't work with the Conservatives, they've ruled that out, so that leaves the Lib Dems.
Overall, we know that Labour has been, as far as anyone has, the winner in Wales. Who's the losers?
I think the clear losers are Plaid. They started off with 15 seats, they've ended up with 11.
And why things panning out so differently for nationalists in Wales than in Scotland?
Well, they think it's partly because they were the junior partner in a coalition, so they've had the same sort of problems the Lib Dems have had because of the Lib Dem Conservative coalition at Westminster. There's also been complaints that their campaign simply hasn't been good enough.
So obviously, Steve, we've been hearing all day about disappointment for the Liberal Democrats in England, but could opportunity knock in Cardiff?
They've done okay in the end. There was talk there could be a real wipeout of Lib Dems in Wales. In the end, they've ended up with 5 seats. That's down just 1. And as we've said, they could find themselves in some sort of agreement with Labour and some sort of power at the Assembly at the end of all this.
Stephen Morris there, raising the intriguing prospect that the Liberal Democrats might find themselves moving from opposition into power in at least one part of the country. But the final devolved government voting taking place today was in Northern Ireland, and Henry McDonald is there for us. As we speak, getting into Friday evening, there's not any results yet, are there?
I can break the news to you. We just had our first result at long last, Newry and Armagh. Now, 3 members of the Assembly were elected. Sinn Féin topped the poll with over 7,000 with their former minister in the last partial in government, Conor Murphy. He exceeded the quota. This is a single transferable vote election. And following him shortly afterwards was the SDLP's Dominic Bradley and the Ulster Unionist deputy leader Danny Kennedy. That's the first results. It's been painfully slow, to say the least. We've had all kinds of glitches and problems because election staff have had to count 3 separate ballot papers, one for the local government elections, which won't even be counted until probably Tuesday at this stage, the AV referendum, we had a vote in that too, and of course the Assembly elections for our devolved Parliament. So the complexity of that has created a really late vote, and it will not really be until tomorrow when we get the final picture, apropos the Assembly.
How's the campaign gone? At one point people were sort of talking about Martin McGuinness from Sinn Féin being First Minister, but that seems to have faded as a prospect, isn't it?
I think that was a tactic by the Democratic Unionist Party to galvanise their vote and get it out, and it seems to have worked. No, Martin McGuinness will not be First Minister. It will be Peter Robinson once more. And Robinson, just think about this here. 12 months ago, he was down on the dumps. He was on the floor. You know, the revelations had come out about his wife and the scandal with her teenage lover and all the business transactions that were going on. He then lost his seat as MP for East Belfast. When he arrived at the count for East Belfast, which was held in nearby Newton Ards this afternoon, he was treated like a hero. There was cheers and renditions of "He's a Jolly Good Fellow." He was looked fairly triumphant because he's probably going to top the poll in East Belfast, and his party will still be the largest party in Stormont, ergo he's First Minister.
And just tell us very briefly, what have been the big issues of the campaign? Has it been this lurking threat in the background of militant republicanism, or is it more bread and butter stuff?
Yes, I mean, to a certain extent, that kind of played a subliminal kind of role in galvanising unionist voters to come out. But I must say, you know, the election for the first time in Northern Ireland history, recent history, have been about socioeconomic issues. They've been about the NHS. They've been about, rising unemployment, the demand that Northern Ireland has the same low corporation tax as the Irish Republic has just across the border. It's been very interesting. And Sinn Féin and the DUP, although the DUP have fired up fears over Martin McGuinness being First Minister, they played a double game. They, on television debates, Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness have sort of protected each other and looked after each other, and you'd almost wonder as if they were an electoral pact rather than unionists and nationalists together.
So, normal news is good news there from Northern Ireland.
And one academic pointed out, just this last point, that the lower turnout, we've had a lower turnout than ever, our turnouts are still higher than they are in Britain. The lower turnout suggests that politics itself is becoming more normal because it's no longer about existential questions about the state and keeping the other side out, where maybe 80% of the electorate would vote. Maybe the fact that a lot of people stayed away shows people are confident in the future.
Henry McDonald there in Belfast. Now for a closer look at what's been happening in the town halls around England, I'm joined on Skype by Mike Smithson of Political Betting. Mike, you're a Liberal Democrat as well as a scholar of these matters. Has it been a fairly terrible day for your tribe?
I think this will hurt. This is a whole series of reasons. The projected national share of the vote that was being talked about before the elections was set at about 16-17%. In fact, it's only about 15%. So it's this today has really hurt the Lib Dems very, very hard. And no doubt there'll be lots of different political ramifications from that.
We know that they've had a disaster in Scotland. They've had some losses in Wales. Can you see any pattern in where they've done worse and where they've held up within England?
That's quite hard, actually. I mean, clearly, where they've had, in the big northern cities, which extraordinarily over the last 20 years had actually seen Labour support slip away, and the Lib Dems sort of filled the void, well, that's now being reversed. And I think everybody was expecting that. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous that we should be talking that the Lib Dems are losing control of Newcastle, Hull, and cities which you'd think would be normally in Labour control. So there's a lot of seats gone there. There have been one or two bright spots, and it's very hard to identify why there have been bright spots. I mean, take Burnley in northwest England. You would expect that to be a pretty appalling battleground for them today. And in fact, they've done quite well. I think they've had a sort of increase. Also in Burnley, we've seen a further reduction in the BNP's seat contingent, which I think that a lot of people see as a good thing.
How about the Conservatives? I mean, some of the hype was saying they'd lose hundreds upon hundreds of seats. It looks like they might come out about level pegging, doesn't it?
I think that in terms of the expectation war, the Tories have done absolutely brilliantly. I mean, they went along with all of this. We're going to lose a lot of seats. And in fact, you know, it looks as though they're going to end up certainly as a net plus on the night, which is quite extraordinary given that that Labour have advanced so much in shares. Remember, when these seats fought last time, Labour was on about 26%. Now the national share has Labour on about 37%. It's been quite extraordinary. And I think that the person who'll be most pleased tonight, apart from Alex Salmond, will be David Cameron. I mean, this is an extraordinary performance of the Tories.
What about Labour? We know that Labour's had an absolute devastating night in Scotland, but in England it seems a much more mixed picture.
I think Labour will be disappointed about the scale of their wins. I think that they picked up quite a few councils. They're going to pick up maybe 750 seats, which is progress, but it's nothing like the sort of progress that I think they probably would have hoped to have been making. Remember, they started the elections yesterday morning with holding 17.3% of the seats in England that were being contested. They're going to finish up with about 25% of the seats that were contested. Now, that's fine, but they do need to be doing, I think, much better than this. And I think one of the problems that Labour have got, it's a massive challenge, is that over the difficult years, their support sort of hollowed out in certain areas. Their activists go, they lose council seats, nobody becomes interested. And it takes a lot of time. What happens is in local parties, if you've got a councillor, or you've got a set of councillors, the councillors receive quite substantial allowances, and that gets fed into the party machine. I mean, some parties tithe. But they also create an organisational objective to keep those council seats. And once you start losing council seats and you really get hammered and hammered and hammered, it takes a year, your whole structure starts to hollow out. And I think that's what's happened to Labour in the last decade or so. And I think that they're going to have to do a lot of rebuilding.
Martin, for the Liberal Democrats, there's not many silver linings here, are there? I mean, maybe they'll get a taste of power in Wales, but the pretty dire results in England, even more dire in Scotland, and worst of all, perhaps, the AV result.
No, obviously, a really terrible day, terrible week, terrible time for the Liberal Democrats. I mean, I think if you were going to kind of whistle in the dark as a Liberal Democrat, what you'd say is that 15% whilst grim and bad, you know, isn't quite as bad as some of the national opinion polls over the last year have shown. It may be that that anger effect against the Liberal Democrats in the coalition may be wearing off a little bit. You might say that that the Burnley result or the holding on in places like Watford, very important, marginal, indicative of quite a lot in the home counties, is good too. And there was a good result in Chris Huhne's seat in Eastleigh, which is very interesting. So, you know, there are pockets of reassurance there, you know, that it wasn't quite as cataclysmic as it might have been. But don't let's delude anybody on this. It's been dire. One in three voters for the Liberal Democrats in 2010 has walked away from them this time, and it's had a really profound effect on the party. It's going to shake the party it's going to really alarm the party internally, and it's going to make the management of the coalition extremely difficult. And of course it's a disastrous result for the Liberal Democrats.
What about Nick Clegg? I mean, we'll remember Cleggmania, which kind of came and went. It went during the election campaign as well as arriving. He lost seats in the 2010 general election. He's lost all the seats we've been talking about around the country today. He's lost the referendum he'd pinned such hopes on. Can he just keep going?
I think circumstances probably mean he does keep going. I think the question of Clegg's leadership is on the table, though, but I don't think it's necessarily on the table this week or next week. I think it's now there sometime in this parliament. I think, you know, depending on when we start really homing in on a general election, then I think the question of whether Clegg is the man to lead the Liberal Democrats into that general election will become the same sort of question that we had in the Labour Party before the last general election about Gordon Brown. Now, Gordon Brown hung on there and led his party to defeat. I think most people in the Lib Dems think there won't be a change of leadership this side of the general election, but I don't think it can be entirely ruled out. And, you know, we'll just have to see. It depends very much on when the next general election is.
And do you rule out the prospect of a split?
I don't think there will be a split in the Liberal Democrats. It's impossible, you know, silly to say never. And, you know, you may get the odd defection to Labour or to sit as an independent radical Liberal Democrat, or people saying they don't want to take the whip, that this sort of thing. We may get a bit of diffusion like that. That's perfectly possible. But I think basically, you know, the Liberal Democrats did vote to go into this coalition with their eyes open. They knew what the risks were. They knew what the programme was. That, you know, they haven't, on the whole, with the single important exception, very important exception of the NHS reform, really been sold a pig in a poke. They knew what they were going to be having to defend over the next 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, I think the Lib Dems will hold together, but, you know, their heart and their head are in different places. They know that they have signed up to this to the coalition and will stick with it. On the other hand, most of them are on the left, and most of their voters are, as the results this week have confirmed. And that's going to help the people like Simon Hughes or Paddy Ashdown, Charles Kennedy, those kind of Liberal Democrats who say, you know, look, this party stands for something, and we're not getting a dividend for what we stand for. We're only providing numbers to get the Tories' side of the deal through.
I mean, and this is what Paddy Ashdown and others are talking about: no more Mr. Nice Party kind of thing. We're going to go and argue hard with the Conservatives. I saw Bill Cash, though, earlier on TV, right-wing Conservative, saying these people are discredited, no one's voting for them anymore, and you know what, we're not going to take any notice of them. Cameron might not be that contemptuous, but that's the danger, isn't it, that they're now negotiating from a weak position?
I don't think Bill Cash counts for much. I mean, he's a representative of himself and of a few people like him. He almost destroyed the Tory party at once. I don't think the current generation of leaders of the Tory party are going to have any serious truck with him trying to do it again.
But
coalitions are coalitions, you know, and so, you know, obviously there are some very right-wing people in the Tory party who it's odd to find under the same banner as some quite left-wing people in the Liberal Democrats. But that's, you know, that's what we've bought. And so I think, you know, I think on the whole that the power of the Tory right to really threaten Cameron is much overstated. I think, you know, they can make a lot of noise on the web. They can make quite a lot of noise in a meeting of the 1922 from time to time. But on the whole, I don't think they count for anything much more. And if there was a leadership contest in the Tory party, I'm quite sure they wouldn't get a new leader of the Tory party to succeed David Cameron, who was significantly different from Cameron himself in the approach that he took to the coalition.
And of course, Cameron strengthened his own hand very considerably today by not losing out, but he does have a strategic choice, doesn't he? Because he was forced into this coalition, although he embraced it out of necessity. He can now either think, well, it's working quite well for me, so I'll strain every sinew to make the thing work and go the distance and give the Lib Dems lots of concessions that I don't really have to give them on NHS reform or whatever. Or he might decide, actually, I'd quite like to have a majority so I don't have to bother with these pesky coalition reconciliation committees. Do you think you can tell which way he'll go already?
Not absolutely, but all my instinct is that he will play it long and that, I mean, he said today in an interview that you know, he'd signed up for the coalition for 5 years. He almost went out of his way to repeat that. I don't think he will be strewing gifts the way of Nick Clegg. I don't think there's much incentive to do that. But I think on the NHS, I think he will make some significant moves, and I think he will present it entirely from the point of view of the Tory party. and rightly so on one level, because, you know, his smartest move as leader has been to, over the years he's been leader, 6 years now, has been to detoxify, you know, it's the cliche of the moment, to detoxify the Tory brand. And central to that was the NHS, and I think he's... he recognises, given every indication that he recognises that that they've slipped back on that. So I think, you know, they have their own motivation to make some concessions on the NHS reforms. How important they are, how material they are, is another matter. I think Cameron and indeed the Liberal Democrats, I think the whole coalition stands or falls by whether the economy recovers in 2013, 2014, and people feel that the pain has been worth it. If enough people think that, that government's going to be re-elected in some form or another, possibly an outright Tory majority, but quite possibly, I wouldn't rule it out, another Lib Dem Tory coalition is still on the cards. And of course, Labour's got a lot to say and will have a lot to do to see whether that happens.
But can I just finally pick you up on that last point? Because, of course, despondent Liberal Democrats today will be thinking, looking at these results, the Tories have held their own. It's the Liberal Democrats who've taken all the pain in the bad times. Why should they believe that when the good times arrive, that they're going to be rewarded for George Osborne's wager if it pays off?
Well, I think that's a fair point. And I don't foresee the Liberal Democrats making sweeping gains at the next general election. Even I don't see that happening. But, you know, as we've seen in some of these local elections, the Lib Dems are pretty well dug in. They're quite tenacious. They're difficult to defeat in some of their seats, certainly in the south of England. Interesting thing here in Scotland and Wales is that some quite big names have lost their seats in the sense of their parliamentary constituencies have gone over to the SNP or have gone Tory in the case of Wales. You know, Ming Campbell, Charles Kennedy, their seats are now SNP seats in Scotland. I would think that Ming Campbell may not fight the next general election if he's wise. I think the the real point for the Lib Dems is they can survive. And you know, I mean, they may do rather worse or they may do a little bit better than they're doing now. But I think, you know, they will still survive. And all that that means is, you know, it comes down to the numbers in the general election next time. We've seen that when the two main parties are stuck in the mid-30s, you can get a range of results. And that's still the case today. Look at the polling figures, the share of the vote figures in the local elections, and both Labour and the Tories are still stuck in the mid-30s. And both of them find it very difficult to get up into the 40s. And whilst that's the case, the prospect of a hung parliament still exists.
So, there we have it. The AV vote might be lost, but there's still reason to think that we might be in for an era of coalition politics. Thank you to Martin Kettle for coming in and explaining all of that. Thanks also to Severin Carroll, Stephen Morris, Mike Smithson and Henry McDonald, all of whom we heard from earlier. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.